This is Orson Welles, speaking from London.
To keep you in suspense.
I had a be everyday grind.
Night transmissions. Hello, good evening, day, whatever it is when you're listening to this. Generally, I conceive of this being listened to at night, so occasionally, just out of, what would you call it? Habit of thought that has no relationship to reality, you'll catch me saying tonight, or this evening, during my introductions. Anyway, I'm Gary Clinton. This is Night Transmissions number 119, and I have something a little bit different with a presentation from the Screen Guild Theater. The Screen Guild Theater was a very popular anthology series that ran from 1939 until 1952, using leading Hollywood actors and would perform adaptations of popular motion pictures, such as Going My Way or The Postman Always Rings Twice, generally things that aren't really suitable for night transmissions. Although in its 527 episodes, there are occasional programs that are very well suited. Others, like this one, which maybe you have to pound on a little bit with a hammer to shape them into the night transmissions mold. But maybe not too much. This is a 30-minute adaptation of the motion picture Arsenic and Lode Lace, which in itself was, by the way, the adaptation of a Broadway play that ran for quite a long time on Broadway. In fact, it ran so long that the movie Arsenic and Lode Lace was made in 1941, but not released until 1944, because Arsenic and Lode Lace, the stage play, was still going great guns. If you've seen Arsenic and Lode Lace, you may have been struck by how obviously the Raymond Massey portrayal of Jonathan Brewster was based on Boris Karloff. There were even a few jokes in the movie about how his plastic surgeon, who was drunk at the time he performed the operation, made him look like Boris Karloff. He's quite annoyed by this, and is insisting that the plastic surgeon fix this. Well, one of the reasons that he looks so much like Boris Karloff and acts so much like Boris Karloff is because in the screenplay, Boris Karloff played Jonathan Brewster. But when the movie was made, had other commitments. Now, as I said, this is a 30-minute, well, you know, actually less than that, probably closer to a 25-minute adaptation of a full-fledged motion picture. How did that work out? Well, actually pretty well. It kind of just stays with the main line of the story, drops some of the secondary plots, and just follows the storyline between Mortimer Brewster and his two aunts. There's a certain amount of narration necessary to stitch the parts together. But really, they did a pretty good job of condensing the movie down to the 25 or so minutes that they have. I guess it might be, if I wasn't familiar with the movie, I might have found the plotline a little more difficult to follow. Could be. But most of us are quite familiar with the plotline and will have no difficulty. Here we go. From November the 26th of 1946, we have the Screen Guild Theater's adaptation of Arsenic and Lode Lace.
The performance shall commence momentarily. We would like to remind you that all photography or recording of any kind is strictly prohibited. Please take a moment and turn off all cellular phones, pagers, and other electronic devices. I believe not a single soul would enjoy hearing your repugnant ringtone or seeing your sallow screen light. I entreat you, turn them off. Prairie Repertory Theater is generously sponsored by the SDSU Students Association, Brookings Radio, and the South Dakota Arts Council. Thank you for joining us for this performance. Sit back, stay lively, and enjoy Arsenic and Old Lace.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. Tonight, Lady Esther has the pleasure of bringing you one of the famous hits of our generation. Joseph Kesselring's Arsenic and Old Lace, originally produced on Broadway by Russell Krauss and Howard Lindsay. It stars Boris Karloff from the original cast and one of Hollywood's most popular young actors, Eddie Albert. And here they are, appearing with the Lady Esther Screen Guild players in Arsenic and Old Lace. You could ask anybody in that section of Brooklyn, and they all would tell you the very same thing. The neighbors, the minister, Dr. Harper, even O'Hara, the cop on the beat.
You mean them two old Brewster sisters? Why, there ain't two sweeter little ladies in the world. Too bad, though, about that nephew of theirs. Too bad, he's sort of...
Charge! Charge! Follow me, men! Up San Juan Hill after Teddy Roosevelt!
See what I mean?
But the Brewster sisters have another nephew, Mortimer. He's dramatic critic on a New York paper. And he's always considered himself quite sane until tonight.
Aunt Evie, Aunt Martha, I have news for you. I'm going to marry Elaine Harper.
Oh, Mortimer, how nice. Our minister's daughter.
Really, Mortimer, we ought to celebrate.
Not tonight, darlings. I've got to pick up Elaine and get back to town. Have to cover a play tonight.
Well, I do hope it's something you like for once. What's the name of it, dear?
Murder Will Out. I'll bet I can write the review without even seeing it.
I always said you were talented, dear.
Same old tripe. When the curtain goes up, first thing you see is a dead body. Well, maybe you won't actually see it. It'll be hidden somewhere, like in this window seat. Then someone will come on, walk in sort of casually, lift the cover up of the window seat like this.
Why, Mortimer, dear, what's the matter?
Aunt Abby, Aunt Martha, there's a dead man in there. Now, look, Aunties, let me say it again slowly. There's a body in the window seat.
Yes, dear, we know.
You know?
Well, of course.
Oh, honestly, I never thought Teddy would ever get... Listen, you were planning to send him to that sanitarium, Happydale?
Yes, dear, it's all arranged. Elaine's father brought the papers over this afternoon. Here they are, all ready for Teddy to sign.
Well, he's got to sign them right away. Tonight. If they ever found out he's killed a man, they'll...
Oh, Teddy didn't do that.
He did... He didn't?
Now, Mortimer, just forget about it. Forget you even saw the gentleman.
Forget?
We never dreamed you'd peek.
But who is he?
His name is Hoskins. Adam Hoskins. That's all I really know about him. Except that he's a Methodist.
Yes, but what's he doing here? What happened to him?
He died.
Aunt Martha, men don't just get into window seats and die.
No, Mortimer. He died first.
How?
Oh, Mortimer, don't be so inquisitive. The gentleman died because he drank some wine with poison in it. Elderberry wine.
How did the poison get in the wine?
Oh, we put it in the wine because it's less noticeable. When it's in tea, it has a distinct odor.
You put it in the wine?
Yes, and we put Mr. Hoskins in the window seat because Elaine's father was coming to tea.
Then you knew what you'd done. You didn't want Dr. Harper to see the body.
Well, not at tea. That wouldn't have been very nice.
Now, Mortimer, dear, you can forget all about it. Teddy's down in Panama right now.
Panama?
You know, the cellar. He always calls the cellar Panama. And the steps over there are San Juan Hill. He's down in Panama now, digging the lock.
You mean you're going to bury Mr. Hoskins in the cellar?
Of course, dear. That's what we did with the others.
Well, I don't think you should... Others?
The other gentleman.
Wait a minute. Let me get this straight. When you say others, do you mean others? More than one? Others?
Oh, Yes, sir. This is 11, isn't it, Abby?
No, dear. This makes 12.
Well, you really shouldn't count the first one. After all, he just died.
Just died?
Well, Martha Means without any help from us. Mr. Midgley was his name. He was a Baptist. And he came here looking for a room.
It was right after you moved to New York, Mortimer.
It didn't seem right to leave that lovely room empty with so many people needing it, so we advertised that Mr. Midgley applied.
He was so lonely, no kith or kin. We felt so sorry for him.
And then when his heart attack came and he sat there dead in that chair. Remember, Martha?
It was just like old times.
Yes.
Grandfather was a doctor, you know. He always had a cadaver or two around the house.
Only Teddy insisted that Mr. Midgley was a yellow fever victim and had to be buried at once. So we buried him in Panama.
Yes. Mm. He looked so peaceful, didn't he, Abby?
Oh, so serene. And we made up our minds right then and there that if we could help other lonely old men find the same peace, we would.
So that's how it all started, that man walking in and dropping dead.
Oh, but of course we realized we couldn't depend on that always happening.
Mortimer, you know those jars of poison that have been up in Grandfather's laboratory all these years?
And your Aunt Martha has such a knack for mixing things.
Well, dear, for a gallon of elderberry wine, I take one teaspoonful of arsenic and then add half a teaspoonful of strychnine and then just a pinch of cyanide.
Should have quite a kick.
Oh, yes, yes. As a matter of fact, one of our gentlemen found time to say, how delicious.
Look, Aunties, I don't know how to explain it to you, but you can't do things like this. It's against the law. It's not a nice thing to do. I mean, well, this has developed into a very bad habit.
Mortimer, we don't stop you from doing things you like to do. Why should you interfere with us?
Because you... Listen, I've got to rush into town and cover that play. Do a lot of things. There's not a minute to spare.
Are you sure you haven't time for dinner? I'm going to try a new recipe.
Thanks. I couldn't eat a thing.
This is it, Doctor.
Yes, I remember this door. Even when I was a child, it always sounded like inner sanctum. Come in.
Oh, Johnny, it is dark in here.
That means the family still live here. The Brewsters were always sparing with lights.
Is that so?
Hey, who turns on the lights?
I did. Who are you?
Yes, what are you gentlemen doing here?
Why, Aunt Abby, Aunt Martha, it's Jonathan.
You get out of here.
But I'm Jonathan, your nephew Jonathan.
Oh, no, you're not. You're nothing like Jonathan, so don't pretend you are.
But I am. I'm Jonathan. And this is Dr. Einstein.
Abby, his voice does sound like Jonathan's.
But his face, have you been in an accident?
No. My face, Dr. Einstein is responsible for that. He changes people's faces. I ought
to... Easy, Johnny, easy. Don't worry, ladies. The last 5 years, I give Johnny 3 new faces. I give him another one right away.
You'd better, when my own family doesn't even...
Oh, Johnny, I'm sorry. I saw that horror picture just before I operated, and I was a little drunk. Well, anyway, now you are home. Ladies, how often he tells me about Brooklyn, about his house, about his aunts that he loves so much. Oh, please, you must know him. Speak to him. Tell him so.
Well, Jonathan, it's been a long time since you ran away from us.
Yes, where have you been all these years?
Oh, England, South Africa, Australia, the last 5 years. Dr. Einstein and I have been in Chicago.
Really? We were in Chicago for the World's Fair.
We didn't like it. We found Chicago awfully warm.
Yeah, it got too hot for us, too.
Well, Jonathan, it was nice to see you again. I mean, if you're in a hurry to get somewhere...
Not at all, Aunt Abby.
Martha, we mustn't let soup boil over. Jonathan, if you'll excuse us for a minute.
Of course.
Come along, Martha.
Johnny, we have got to work fast. The police have got pictures of your face. I've got to find a place to operate.
And we've got to find a place for Mr. Spinalzo, too.
Don't waste any worry on that rat.
But we can't leave a dead body in the rumble seat. Oh, you shouldn't have killed him, Johnny. He was a nice fellow. He gives us a lift, and what happens?
He said I looked like Boris Karloff.
Don't worry, Johnny. As soon as I operate and change your face again...
Wait a minute. I know just the place.
You do?
Look, if this family hasn't changed, and I'm sure it hasn't, I'll bet my grandfather's old laboratory is just the way he left.
Oh, good.
And when you've done with me, why, we can make a fortune here.
In Brooklyn?
Of course. Practically everybody in Brooklyn needs a new face.
But, Johnny, your aunts, I don't think they want us here.
Leave that to me, Doctor. I'll handle it. Why, this house will be our headquarters for years.
Oh, that would be beautiful, Johnny. This nice, quiet house, those sweet old ladies. I love them already. I get the bags, yeah?
Doctor, we must wait till we're invited.
But you just said...
We'll be invited.
If they say no?
Doctor, two helpless old women. Sit down and make yourself comfortable.
It's like comes through a beautiful dream. It's so nice and peaceful here.
That's what makes this house so perfect for us. It's so peaceful.
Sam on Hillman! Charge! Charge!
Well, I must say, my dear aunts, it was very kind of you to invite the doctor and myself to dinner.
We didn't really invite you, Jonathan. You invited yourself.
Well, it just shows you I feel at home already. I'm sure I'm going to like it here.
Like it here? You mean you're going to stay?
Oh, hadn't I told you?
Now, Jonathan, you needn't think you're going to stay.
Abby, the dinner dishes. Shouldn't we get started on them, dear?
Huh? Yes, of course. Jonathan, we'll speak to you later.
Johnny, just now that Teddy takes me down the cellar, and what do you think I find?
What?
The Panama Canal.
The Panama Canal.
Listen. He digs a hole down there. Just the right size for Mr. Spinalzo.
Say, that's an idea. What a joke on my aunts to bury a body in their cellar.
But how are we going to get him in?
Get him in through those French windows. We can hide him in the window seat.
The window seat?
It's perfect for a corpse. Why, when I was a youngster, I used to hide there myself. Then, a little later on, when my aunts have gone to bed, we'll take him down and bury him.
But suppose they come in here and find us?
My dear doctor, you don't understand. My aunts are doing the dinner dishes. They'll be in the kitchen for quite some time.
Oh, they will?
Yes, they've always kept a very neat home. Shall we go?
But, Abby, are you sure they've gone out?
Yes, they're out there at their car. Besides, we've got to get Mr. Hoskins out of this window seat.
Yes, poor dear. He can't be very comfortable.
And when Mortimer gets back, he'll take care of Jonathan.
There'll be an awful row. They've never liked each other.
Martha, I will not invite Jonathan to Mr. Hoskins' services.
Abby, dear, we better hurry.
Yes, let's see if Teddy is still in the cellar.
Teddy, are you down there in Panama?
Who dares call the president by his first name?
Mr. President, we've got another gentleman.
Is he dead?
A yellow fever victim. Teddy, I'm afraid you'll have to hurry.
Ah, that's it, Doctor. That's fine. See how nicely he fits?
Just like this window seat was made to order.
Now we'll go upstairs. When my aunts have gone to sleep, we'll come down and put him away. And after that...
I know, Johnny, I know. I operate.
Well, everything seems quiet enough. They must be sleeping, I guess. Might as well have a little light down here. And that's better. Now, let me see. First, I've got to get Hoskins out of the window seat. It's not very pleasant, but it's got to be done. Come on, old man. I'm sorry to disturb you.
Ooh, another one!
Mortimer!
Darling, you're back. Just in time for the services.
Aunt Abby, Aunt Martha, there's another body in the window seat. Look!
Now, who can that be?
Why, it's a stranger. My goodness, how did he get in there?
Now, wait a minute, you two. You can't get out of this. That's another one of your gentlemen.
Mortimer, how can you say such a thing? That man's an imposter.
But you admitted... You admitted you put Mr. Hoskins in the window seat.
Well, yes, I did, but I...
Well, this man couldn't have just got the idea from Mr. Hoskins. By the way, where is Mr. Hoskins?
Teddy took him down to Panama. Yes, he's down there waiting for the services. Oh, Abby, dear, we've always wanted to hold a double funeral.
No, Martha. I will not read services over a total stranger.
Stranger? Aunt Abby, there are 12 men buried down there in the cellar. You admit you poisoned them. Now you try to tell me this one is a stranger?
Well, of course. Darling, you don't think I'd stoop to telling a fib?
Now, Lady Esther presents the second act of Arsenic and Old Lace, starring Eddie Albert and Boris Karloff, with Verna Felton and Jane Morgan. Well, Mortimer thinks he's going crazy until his brother Jonathan walks in. That makes the answer fairly apparent, and Mortimer shifts right into high. He tells him he's going to call the police and show them the very dead Mr. Smith Halsell. And it looks like his bluff is going to work when Dr. Einstein comes rushing in.
Johnny!
Come along, Doctor. It seems that we are leaving.
No, Johnny, wait. Just now that Teddy takes me down to Panama again, and guess what?
What?
Johnny, we stay. We got an ace in the hole.
Now, Jonathan discovers poor dead Mr. Hoskins, and that changes things all around again, especially since Mortimer has to leave to finish some very urgent business. And now, while they're awaiting Mortimer's return, the two old ladies are quite upset.
Jonathan, will you please tell us what you plan doing with your Mr. Spinalzo?
Going to bury him with your Mr. Hoskins, I suppose.
Oh, no, you won't. We won't have any strangers buried in our cellar.
And besides, the cellar's crowded already.
Yes. There are 12 graves down there right now.
12 graves?
But you can see that leaves us very little room, and we're going to need it.
You mean you two ladies have murdered all those?
Murdered? Certainly not. It's one of our charities.
Why, what we've been doing is a mercy.
You've done that here in this house, and you've buried them down there?
Johnny, we have been chasing all over the world. They stay right here at home and do just as good as you do.
What?
You got 12? They got 12.
I've got 13.
No, Johnny, 12.
13.
No, Johnny, you can't count the one in South Bend. He died of pneumonia.
He wouldn't have got pneumonia if I hadn't shot him.
No, Johnny, he don't count. He don't count. You got 12 and they got 12. The old ladies are just as good as you are.
Oh, they are they? Well, that's easily taken care of. All I need is one more. That's all. Just one more.
Well, here I am.
Oh, please, young man, take my advice. Go away from this house. Go away now while Johnny is still busy in the cellar with Mr. Spinalzo.
I'm sorry, Doctor. I'm expecting someone. Someone very important. Besides, I've still got to write my review.
I tell you, Johnny is in a bad mood, and when he's like this, he is a madman.
Don't worry, I'll take care of Jonathan, too.
Ach, Himmel, don't you got no sense? Don't you learn nothing from those plays you see?
Are you kidding? You think people in plays act intelligently? You should have seen the one I had to cover tonight. There's a fellow in this play, knows he's in a house with murderers. He's even been warned. But does he get out? No, he stays there. Now, I ask you, Doctor, is that intelligent?
You are asking me.
He didn't even have sense enough to be on guard. For instance, the murderer invites him to sit down.
Oh, you mean, won't you sit down?
Believe it or not, that was in there, too. So what happens? He sits down, just like this. What do you think they tie him with?
What?
The curtain cord.
That's very convenient.
A little too convenient. When are these playwrights going to use some imagination? So he sits there, the big dope. This fellow who's supposed to be bright, he sits there just like I'm sitting here, letting murder walk up behind him, just waiting to be trussed up and gagged.
You're quite right, my dear brother. That fellow wasn't very smart. Well, he seems to be gagged and tied quite well. All right, Doctor. We go to work.
Please, Johnny, first I need a drink. Oh, there's some wine here.
Oh, yes, the elderberry wine. By all means.
I pour you one, too. Oh, how I need this.
Please, Doctor, your manners. Not without a toast. To my dear dead
Charles,
brother.
Charles!
Oh, Himmel!
That idiot. He goes next. You hear me? He's next.
No. Oh, no, Johnny, not Teddy.
We'll get to him later. Come on. We've got to work fast.
Hey, what is this?
It's the cops.
Listen, that Teddy's got to quit blowing his horn. We promised the neighbors.
All right, officer. We'll speak to him.
I better talk to him myself. Where's the lights? That's better. I'll go up to his room and Hey, ain't that Mr. Mortimer?
Yes, it is.
What's he doing tied up like that?
He was explaining the play he saw tonight. That's what happened to the fellow in the play.
No kidding? Well, I wouldn't want to interfere.
Hey, O'Hara.
Oh, hiya, Brophy. How's the prowl car business?
Not kind of warm.
Lieutenant Steven.
Did he get you on the radio?
Yeah, he says he got so many complaints from the neighbors, you'd think they dropped an atom bomb on Flatbush Avenue. He says we got to take Teddy and... what's that guy trussed up like that?
Oh, that's Mr. Mortimer. He's playing.
Well, get him untied. He looks like he's choking.
Oh, sure. It won't take me but a second.
Officer, perhaps you'd better let me...
Hey, who is this guy?
That's my brother. And you'd better stick around because he...
Don't listen to him, officer. He's dangerous.
Huh?
That's why we had to tie him up. He's the lowest kind of person in the whole world.
A dramatic critic?
And my two aunts. Huh. You think they're sweet, charming old ladies, do you? Well, there are 13 bodies buried in their cellar.
Listen, you be careful what you say about your aunts. They happen to be friends of ours. Hey, Brophy, can you imagine with a puss like his? Why, he looks just like Boris Karloff.
Why, are you?
Hey, wait a minute. Why, you? Hey, Brophy, help me.
Let go,
Brophy.
You. What's the idea? You hear me?
I said let go.
Better take care of him for a while.
What was biting him? Choking me like that.
I don't know. When you said he looked like it... Hey, wait a minute. This guy is wanted.
You sure?
Sure. Don't you ever read Truth Detective? He escaped from an asylum. Well, that's the way he was described. He looked like Karloff.
Is there a reward?
Yeah, yeah. Help me lug him out to the car.
But how about the bodies in the cellar?
Bodies in the cellar? Ain't that enough to show you he's nuts?
Hey, what about the other one? You know who I mean, Mr. Mortimer.
The doctor.
Yeah, he must have walked out.
Don't worry, we'll pick him up. Come on.
Mr. Mortimer, you'll excuse us, huh? I mean, seeing as hot as a reward.
I understand.
But you will take care of Teddy, though.
Absolutely. Tonight. Aunt Martha, Aunt Abby, I know it's very late, but you see... Mr. Witherspoon came all the way over here. He's the superintendent of Happydale, you know.
He is? How nice.
Yes, and all the papers have been signed, and he's going to take Teddy with him tonight.
Really, Mr. Witherspoon?
Well, that was my understanding.
Mortimer, does Teddy know?
Not exactly. He thinks he's going on a safari to Africa.
Abby, dear, we'll miss Teddy, won't we? We'll love him so.
Oh, I've fixed all that too, Aunt Martha. You and Aunt Abby are going along just so you can be close to Teddy.
Why, Mortimer, how thoughtful of you. Yes, isn't that nice? And, Mortimer, you can have the house.
The house?
Of course, you'll need it if you're going to marry Elaine.
Elaine? Holy Toledo, she must still be waiting. Excuse me, I've got to go and call her.
He's such a good boy, Mr. Witherspoon.
Yes, yes, I'm sure.
You know, since we're all going away together, I think we ought to celebrate, have a party.
I'm sorry, but I'm here in an official capacity.
Oh, that's too bad. Tell me, does your family live at Happydale, too?
I'm afraid I haven't any family.
You're all alone. Oh, isn't that too bad? You know, Martha, if Mr. Witherspoon won't let us give him a party... At least we might offer him a glass of wine. Of course, the elderberry wine.
Elderberry wine?
We make it ourselves.
Well, of course, at Happydale, our relationship will be much more formal. But here...
Oh, we're very informal. Yes. Go ahead, Martha. Pour him a glass.
Thank you.
Motion Picture Relief Fund, thank you, Boris Karloff, Eddie Albert, Jane Morgan, and Berna Felton, for your delightful performances. This is CBS, the Columbia Broadcasting System.
Lady Esther 4-Purpose Face Cream does the four things your skin needs most for beauty. And it's so gentle and soft, you don't have to massage and rub at your skin. My cream itself does the work, not your fingers. And it needs no help from any other cream. Try this with Lady Esther 4-Purpose Face Cream. Sure as you do, someone will say to you, "Why, I've never seen you look so rested, so fresh and young. You know, you look like a young girl in love."
Well, we're going to go to Down Under. Well, you know, not that Down Under. One of the other Down Unders. In this case, South Africa. Give a listen to The Creaking Door, which ran between 1964 and 1965, and was their own homegrown version of Inner Sanctum, right down to the creaking door. Its connections are obvious, but nonetheless, it does stand on its own as a well-produced, quite engaging supernatural thriller series. The production values are high, and is a good example of what the South African Broadcasting System, South African Broadcasting Company, and Springbok Radio could do. They had several really good shows. I mean, Beyond This is Beyond Midnight and SF-68 and several others. They were well introduced by Peter Broomfield, who, I'm sorry to say, was not quite up to the caliber of Raymond Edward Johnson over at the Inner Sanctum. But he did do a good job. I've kind of looked around on the internet for Peter Broomfield, and I can't report to you very much about him, other than that he was in South Africa during the years required to be the announcer for The Creaking Door. I never quite know what I should do about introductions to these shows. I have this tendency to think I should just shut up and get out of the way so you folks can listen to this. On the other hand, maybe I should do something short so you kind of know what you're getting into and can maybe figure out that you don't want to hear this one and just skip 30 minutes. So I will say about this, that the story opens at the graveside of a local gangster. Yeah, everyone's there. His gang, his loyal soldiers, his rivals, and even the coppers are there. They are all observing a day of truce, hence the name of the program, A Day of Truce. It originally aired on October the 12th of 1964.
I have flown, I have sailed, I have moved about this world of ours. And ever in search of the finest of its kind, we bring you the Tops in Pine Chillers. The Creaking Door. The manufacturers of State Express 3-5 Filter King cigarettes take pleasure in presenting The Creaking Door. Good evening, friends of the Creaking Door. The Creaking Door is open. So do grab in. Why the pause? Listening to the strange noises coming from above. Oh, don't let it worry you. It's merely the articulation of a worried corpse. He finds that he cannot enter into the spirit of the thing.
American World Trust. Get the taste of new smooth State Express 3-5s today. We promise you, it's the smoothest cigarette you can get. It's a blend that has been perfected after years of constant research by our master blenders. And the recent development of an entirely new process which gives you an even smoother 3-5 smoke. We promise you, it's the smoothest cigarette you can get. Smooth in world class. Get the taste of new smooth State Express 3-5 today.
Churchyard, the friends gather in the fog to mourn a dead man. An organ drones over the scene. The coffin is lowered into the earth, and the sad mourners don't even watch each other. It is a day of truce.
Poor old Butch. Who'd have thought his heart was so bad?
Yeah, who'd have thought it?
Well, listen to us all, Carla. Could be any one of us. Now, if you died of violence, I could have understood it.
That cop, Inspector Sharp, he's watching you.
Huh? What a rat. Don't he show any respect on a day like this?
Shh. It's coming over.
Hello, Red. Hello, Carla.
Hello, Inspector Sharp.
Happy now?
Happy. Butch was a good friend of mine.
Carl Alfred is your biggest enemy, and you know it.
Oh, what a thing to say.
If you'd killed him, I wouldn't be a bit surprised.
It's a lie. I never done it. I was framed.
Oh, I know. He's dead. It's natural. Dr. Moore says so, and everything he says is true.
That's right. He signed the death certificate.
Yeah. You've got no grounds for suspicion.
Unfortunately, no. See you around, Red. And you, Carter. I'm off now. The obsequies is over.
Obsequies?
Yes, the funeral rites. Don't be so suspicious, Red. Bye now.
Miss, not that I wish that on any man. I can't say that Puccinelli will be missed.
No, Red, nobody could say that.
Besides, think of the things he controlled, eh? All the best records, gambling machines, the racetrack bookies, protection and clubs. Yeah, they do say a little spot of drug running.
He got too big for his boots, he did.
Yeah, and all the mobsters in the city will be running around like dogs looking for the master. Hey, Carla, imagine if I was your master.
That'll be the most, Red, but you ain't.
That's right, but I could be. I'd be governor of the whole scene. Carla, you used to know Butch well, didn't you?
Yeah, I knew him since we was kids.
Tell me, who would be second in the gang? I mean, after Butch.
Black called Kentish Jack. Tough in a fight.
Huh? He is he? I wonder. Just a friend. That, eh?
You got me properly snookered, Red.
Yeah, Charlie, and you ain't the only one either.
You mean the old Butch Hennessy mob?
Yeah, could be, boy. Now, look, Butch died from natural causes. Quintus Jack was shot by an unknown assailant. Who runs that mob now, eh?
I'd rather play this game, Rick.
Oh, we don't keep racketeering up forever, Boyd. That's the mistake people make. They don't know when they've had enough. The way I see it, clean up in a year or two. Go to the Bahamas, somewhere like that. What do you say?
Hey, nobody ever quits the rackets. Never. Everybody knows too much. No, they don't quit. Unless they go the way Butch Hennessy went. Or Kentish Jack come for that. Well, the way I... Oh, that's the signal. Must be the cops. They're on their way.
Yeah. Well, don't worry, boy. They can be on their way. They got nothing on me.
Morning, boys.
Hello, Inspector.
Kentish Jack was killed last night, Red.
So I see from the paper.
Well, you didn't have anything to do with it, did you?
Us? Well, whatever can you mean, Inspector? Well, we got no motive.
Only his rackets, eh, Red? Red, you started something. I'm going to finish. I won't have violence in the city.
I'm a peace-loving man, Inspector. You got me all wrong, honest you have, Mr. Sharp.
Red, you'll end up in jail for life or face downwards in a gutter. And I'll laugh, believe me. Understand this, Red. Break the peace of this city and you'll be destroyed.
That a threat, Inspector?
I don't have to threaten a rat like you. Your own kind will destroy you. Red, did you know that Butch Hennessy left a lot of money?
No. Besides, I wouldn't touch that kind of money.
Maybe you wouldn't. Or couldn't. But somebody has. There wasn't a penny in his safe deposit box. Been cleaned up.
I'd nothing to do with it.
Over 50,000 quid. Gone with the wind.
50,000 quid. Oh, fancy that, eh?
That's right. And the old underworld will be looking for it. Hard cash, Red. And I've heard that Butch isn't sleeping so soundly about it.
What do you mean?
They tell me that his ghost has been seen. That's all, Red.
I don't feel safe. Even in my own flat.
It's all nonsense, Red. There's no such thing as ghosts. Everybody knows that.
I don't know it.
Have another drink, Red.
Right, yes, I will. Look, when I was in Carmore Jail, there was a ghostly cell. The door used to swing open when there was nobody there. You couldn't lock it or nothing. Yeah, I believe in ghosts, all right.
Yeah, but not ghosts of blokes like Butch Hennessy.
I do, I tell you. If there's ghosts of old geezers with their heads cut off, why not of a smart boy like Butch?
Well, what have you been looking for, Red?
Revenge, that's what. Revenge for the death of Kentish Jack, Carla. Now, look, they say all his money's gone. Where? That's what I want to know. Who's got it?
Is it a lot, Red?
That copper sharp says it's 50,000 quid. Any mob would go after that kind of money.
But where would that much money vanish to?
That's what I want to find out. Starting with our late friend Kentish Jack. Look, I'm a fair cracksman. I'll take Charlie and we'll do Jack safe.
I'll bet there's nothing there.
Yeah, well, there may be some kind of clue. We'll try it anyhow. Jack's place is up at the top of a high building. I bet nobody's took it over yet. I'll tell you what we're going to do. We climb the fire escape and then... Right. Now come in, Charlie.
Was easy.
Yeah, well, shut up and follow me. Got your gun?
Hit right here, Reed. I got the torch, the tools, the lot.
Okay, now for the safe. Well, I didn't expect the cash, but isn't there something, a clue, but not a thing. Who's there?
It's only your old pal, Butch Hennessy.
It's his voice. I know it anywhere.
Butch, come up and show yourself.
Are you worried, boys?
Well, I, Butch, look, I've nothing to do with your death, honest.
Where is he, Red?
Shine your torch.
There. Nothing?
Are you looking for something, boy?
There it is again.
That voice is coming from the next room. That's all. The skylight's open.
We'll soon find out.
Nobody there.
Look, there's the stairs going down.
Come on, quick as you like.
That Dang it! Get him!
We'll soon find out if he's a ghost.
Clean away, Charlie boy. He ain't a ghost, that's for sure. But it don't make sense.
You saw him buried. Old Doc Moore signed a certificate.
That's right. And what I want to know is this. Who was in that coffin I saw buried the other day? And there's only one way to find that out.
You mean, have a look?
Yes, that's just what I mean. We'll have to dig up that coffin tomorrow night. Now, let's get out of here before we get pinched.
I don't like it, Red.
That was a lovely shot, Charlie.
No, I don't mean that. I mean, well, digging up that corpse. It's a bad thing to do, disturbing corpses.
Any better suggestions?
No, I suppose not.
Then play your shot like a good little boy and leave the thinking to me, will you?
No, I don't feel like playing, Red.
Go on. Do you think I like waiting the whole day?
I'm scared, I tell you.
Well, I'm scared too. I don't like ghosts and never did. I need to get hold of the records, and nothing's going to stop me, human or inhuman.
Oh, well, you're the boss.
Because I think that's why. Butcher's alive, get it? He's no ghost.
Then why pretend he's dead?
Look, you said a true word the other day, Charlie. You said villains like us never leave the records because nobody will let them. And suppose Butch Hennessy wants to be the first man to walk out.
You've got Ed on you, Red.
Say Butch pretended he was dead. That way, he'd be in the clear.
Yeah, well, then who was in the coffin you saw buried?
The money, Charlie. The lovely money we want to get our hands on.
Well. I wonder what the gangsters will find in the coffin. Treasure hunting in graves can be very dangerous, you know. However, let's find out what the police want with Charlie and Red, shall we?
Yeah, I bet it's that copper sharp.
Yeah, well, what's in now? Ah, lovely shot, Charlie.
Morning, boys.
Hello, Inspector.
Why, if it isn't Mr. Sharp, eh?
Someone broke into a safe last night, I thought you'd like to know.
Well, I never. The things people do for a few quid.
The robbers were armed and fired a gun at somebody. Or something.
That's a serious charge, that is, isn't it, Inspector?
You wouldn't know anything about it, would you?
Me? But I was home all evening. Wasn't I, Charlie?
Oh, yes, we was at home. Anybody hurt Mr. Sharp?
Not this time. But I don't like guns and I don't like safe breakers. And I didn't tell you that both you boys are in serious trouble.
Sharp, we can't be in much more trouble, can we?
Oh, it's Butch Hennessy. He ought to know.
No, he's dead, Mr. Sharp.
Yeah. Do you believe in ghosts, Charlie?
How that's for kids, Inspector.
Well, the whisper's gone around that Butch has come back from the dead. And then you fellas don't believe in ghosts, do you? So, that's all right.
Well, you don't believe in ghosts, do you, Mr. Sharp?
I don't know, Charlie. I don't know. I didn't. Once. Enjoy your game.
Oh, well, he's gone fast enough.
Yeah, but you've got to use your head in this racket. The point is, why did he come here? What's he after?
Us. He'd give good money to put us in jail.
Well, I'll tell you what I think. He came here to rattle us, act as if nothing happened. Look, I'm going to see Carla, and we'll meet tonight, okay?
Yeah, okay. Yeah, I wish it was all over, Red. I'd rather face a squad of cops than that graveyard tonight.
Carla, how's the girl?
All right, Red. Like a drink?
Thanks, kid. Anyone been along?
Not a soul. Sit down and relax.
Yeah, I thought that some of them nosy coppers might have been along. That Inspector Sharp, somebody like that.
No one, Red. You're just jumpy.
I keep thinking of Butch Hennessy. I see him on the street everywhere. Then you turn round and he isn't there.
What's your drink, Red? How did you see Butch? We saw him buried.
I'm not so sure. That's the end of him. Look, you're safe up here in this block of flats. If you lock the kitchen door, no one can get in by the fire escape. That leaves the front door, and if you put the chain on it...
Oh, you have got it bad. Oh, no one will come in here, silly.
Well, maybe. But better safe than sorry. There. You see, if Butch is alive, he might come after you.
Yeah, I suppose you're right, but I...
What's that?
Oh, a cat. The wind, anything.
That noise came from the bedroom. Nobody could be in there. Nobody.
Of course not.
It's Butch. He's in the bedroom.
Oh, that's nonsense.
Yeah? Well, I'm going to see.
See? There's nobody there.
Yeah? Well, he must be hiding. Come out of there.
Well, why don't you look under the bed?
Look, I'm sorry, Carla. I'm jumpy, that's all. I was warned. Look, didn't you hear a laugh?
No, of course not. I thought I heard a bump.
Yeah, well, let's go back to the living room.
Okay, Red.
I see Butch everywhere.
Well, I don't see him. I hear him. If he ain't a ghost, he's mighty like one.
Well, I didn't hear anything anyway.
Look, lad, I'm going to settle this one way or the other tonight. Charlie's coming with me, and we'll dig up Butcher's grave. I reckon the money's there.
The money?
Yeah. Look, Carla, I'm going to spend all the day well out of Hennessy's way, see? There's something you can do for me.
Oh, anything at all, Red, you know that.
Take this gun and ditch it. The clip, ammunition, and everything. It's the gun I used to kill Kentish Jack, and it's too hard to carry. Understand?
Whatever you say, Red.
Good. I've got a sort of feeling that something's going to happen. I'll get picked up or something, so drop it in the river.
Sure, Red. I'll put the gun where no one will ever find it. Where will you spend the day?
Where no one will ever find me, kid. That art gallery. So long, love.
So long, dreamboat. Butch. Butch! Come out now, he's gone.
Thanks, Carla. Oh, it was a bit cramped in that wardrobe.
Well, you had to make a noise. That was the only way.
I didn't expect him today. If he had found me, it would have meant a showdown here.
You make a lousy ghost.
Oh, I don't know. I groan and crackle very convincingly, Carla. That poor boyo, he doesn't know if I'm dead or alive.
You've been seeing too much, Butch. Butch Hennessy's a chap people don't forget in a hurry.
I've still got her fixed up, Carla. I'm dead. We pick up that money from the graveyard and scramble, both of us.
Just you and me?
Sure. Leave these boyos to look for the ghost. I'll quit the rackets. Come with me overseas. A new life is waiting for us. I'll invest in legitimate business, okay?
Sounds wonderful. Butch, why have the money in your coffin in the first place? Doesn't make sense.
Don't you see? It's in cash. Small notes, negotiable currency. Every racketeer in the place was after it. We had to hide it somewhere. Remember what happened to poor Kentish Jack's safe?
That's right. Did you square Dr. Morse?
Sure, he signed the death certificate for money. Morley, the undertaker, too, he worked for money. No, Carla, I've been seen around. But people think I'm a ghost. I'm the first man to break clean as a hound's tooth with a rack.
You make it sound wonderful, Butch. I hope it stays that way.
I swear it will. Everything's fixed. All we have to do is go to the grave and dig up that coffin.
Well, you better be fast, Irisher, because Red's got the same idea.
Has he now? I wonder what I'd do without you, baby.
This is the place, Red.
Sure. Understand what we do? We get in that graveyard and start digging.
Yeah, I'm with you, Red. The dough's there for certain.
All right. That's it.
Are you sure, Red?
Yeah, certain. I saw him buried there, didn't I? At least I saw something buried there in this grave. Besides, look at the earth. It's just been turned over.
Yeah, that's right. It's all loose. Let's start digging.
Now, come on, put your back into it.
Yeah, well, I am trying, mate.
What was that?
It was an owl, Red, that's all.
Well, I don't like owls. I don't like this place. I don't like any of it. Smells wrong to me somewhere.
What do you mean, Red?
I don't know. Something creepy. There's something wrong. Yeah. This earth troubles too easy.
Yeah, well, we'll soon know one way or the other. All right, we touched the coffee lid. Come on, let's dig it out.
I reckon that'll do it.
Yeah.
Right. Take a spade and leave off the lid. There's a fortune in this grass. There. That's done it. Let's see.
Well, what is it, Reed?
Take a look. It's Butch Hennessy's corpse. Who's that?
Carla.
She shot him. The money.
Oh, we shouldn't have come. I told you, the old thing's crazy.
Carla? Where are you? What have you done with the money?
The money? It ain't there.
Not a cent.
Carla, I'll get you if it's the last thing I...
Got you this time, Rick.
We got you into the cells at last, Red.
Yeah, what for? We was found robbing a grave, so
you've
what?
You've got a lot of explaining to do. The grave of a criminal who was supposed to have died 4 days ago. Our police surgeon says Hennessy's been dead for less than 6 hours.
I never shot him. It was Carla. You heard her. She was at the gravesite.
Don't give me that. We've got the automatic found by the graveside with the fingerprints on it.
It was Carla.
Save your breath and tell it to the judge.
Look, you know she was by the grave. You must have been following her for days. Otherwise, how would you have been by the graveside? I told her everything. Now you're trying to frame me for shooting Butch.
You're wrong, Red. Carla's confessed to shooting Butch. We are holding you on a charge. charge of murdering Kentish Jack, otherwise known as John Garseed. I'll be seeing you.
The rotten, filthy... No, not again. You're dead this time. I saw your corpse. This time you must be a real ghost.
Well, well, well. How confusing for poor Red and his friend Charlie. However, the confusion will soon be resolved after they pay the penalty. Once they've made the big drop, the four of them, Kentish Jack, Carla, Red, and Charlie, will all be meeting here, behind the creaking door.
Manufacturers of State Express 3-5's Filter King cigarette invite you to listen next Saturday at 9 o'clock when they will again present The Creaking Door.
Strange Adventure. Of the 20 volunteers from Bakerton, Arizona, that had rallied to the stars and bars of the Confederacy, Sloan Sayers was the first to return. He came back to the little desert town, a disillusioned young man, limping from a leg wound and fed up with the sight of blood and death. He was tired, tired of fighting, and of people that settled their differences with guns. Sayers set about to educate the people of Bakerton to the fact that books, not bullets, would build the West. The scornful, trigger-tempered citizens laughed at him. In spite of the jibes and remarks of his former friends, Sloan went ahead with his plans. With the last of his army pay, he equipped an old adobe house on the edge of town with the bare necessities of a schoolroom and settled down to teach the children of the town and the nearby ranches. All went well until Carl Gould came to town. Gould was a tin-horn gambler and card sharp of a type that at one time flooded the western frontier. Blustering loud in his own praises, a bully of the worst kind, he met Sloan Sayers, heard of the theory, books not bullets, and laughed in his face. He despised this peace-loving man and set out to make his life as miserable as possible. He began to court Sloan's sweetheart, and finally the young schoolteacher protested.
Gould, Nancy and I are going to be married, and I want you to stay away from her.
Here at last was what Gould had been looking for, an excuse to challenge the schoolteacher to a fight.
I'll see her any time I want. If you don't like it, start wearing a gun. We'll see who's the better man.
For a long moment, Sayers stood stiff with anger. Then his body seemed to slump. Gould, you know I don't settle my differences with guns. I haven't carried a gun since the war. I won't fight you. The crowd around the two men was stunned. Sloan Sayers, the hero of the Civil War, had refused to defend his honor. Sloan Sayers was yellow. The men parted as he turned away, as though ashamed to touch this coward. Their silent contempt was more deadly than shouted insults. 2 days later, Gould and his two companions held up and robbed the farmer's bank. In their escape, they killed an aged guard. While the posse searched the hills for the bandits, Gould and his men headed for a safe hideout. They found it, Sayers' schoolhouse. The bandits burst in while class was in session. Gould waved Sayers back with his six gun.
Keep on teaching, schoolmarm. Going to be your last lesson.
The killer stepped close to the teacher's desk. The business end of his revolver aimed at Sloan's middle. The school teacher thought of the heartless threat to the children. Sure that the bandits could not read, he picked up a piece of chalk and wrote, "Down on the floor, everybody." As the children dived for cover, Sayers brought his ruler down across Gould's gun hand. As the weapon fell, he grabbed it, snapped it upward. The six gun flamed three times, and the killers lay dead. That night, Sayers and the children's parents reached an agreement that was to last to the end of his days. Books and bullets would win the West. This is Pat McGeehan saying goodbye for my writer Charles Crowder and inviting you to listen again to another tale of Strange Adventure.
Well, we're going to take a bit of a break right now, but we'll be back very soon with X minus one. Up next is an episode from X-1, which is often called the finest science fiction drama ever produced for radio. I don't know that it was the finest. Maybe so. I mean, it was certainly more dramatized than what I think is the finest. The program I think is the finest is Mind Webs, which I play here from time to time. It was pretty good. Except for Mind Webs, it was, well, probably the best. Because on the other hand, Vanishing Point, which I also play here from time to time, is a remarkable contender for that position. But it's among the top three. It wasn't the first either. That honor belongs to a program called 2000 Plus. It wasn't the second. That would be Dimension X, which ran a few years earlier on NBC and is the direct antecedent of X-1. In fact, the first 15 episodes of X-1's 1955 to 1958 run on NBC as well were new versions of Dimension X episodes. The remainder were almost entirely adaptations of science fiction stories, mostly published in Galaxy Science Fiction magazine, and were written by some really excellent writers. Among those excellent writers is the guy who wrote the story on which tonight's play is based, Clifford D. Simak, who was and still is regarded as one of the finest science fiction writers who ever lived. Simak, who died in 1988 at the age of 84, won the Science Fiction Writers Association of America's third Grand Master Award in 1977. He was only preceded by Robert A. Heinlein and Jack Williamson, which is, of course, an exalted company indeed. But Simak is not out of his element here. During his writing career, he won a plethora of prestigious... How do you like that? Plethora of prestigious. Well, anyway, he'd won the International Fantasy Award for his classic 1953 novel, which, if you haven't read it, is more than a novel about a world gone to the dogs, although that did happen. He won the Bram Stoker Lifetime Achievement Award in 1988. He also had three Hugo Awards for The Big Front Yard in 1959, Way Station in 1964, and Grotto of the Dancing Deer in 1981. There was also a Nebula Award for Grotto of the Dancing Deer in 1981.
Countdown for blast-off. X-minus 5, 4, 3, 2, X-minus 1, fire. From the far horizons of the unknown come transcribed tales of new dimensions in time and space. These are stories of a future, adventures in which you'll live in a million could-be years on a thousand maybe worlds. The National Broadcasting Company, in cooperation with Galaxy Science Fiction Magazine, presents
X-1.
Tonight's story, Junkyard, by Clifford D. Simak.
funny thing about the whole thing was the fact that we had never intended to land on Planet 9. We circled it and decided it was strictly a low-grade affair. It wouldn't amount to anything for a billion years or so. As commander of a galactic survey team, I couldn't waste my time on it. Then my exec saw this junkyard through the telescope. We landed. Took a look at a load of alien machine parts discarded by some other spaceship, and then prepared to take off for Earth. It had all been a waste of time.
Engine room, MacGyver.
This is Commander Warren. All secure?
Yes, sir.
Very well. Count down for blastoff.
Engine room ready, sir.
X minus 5. Minus 4. Minus 3. Minus 2. Minus 1. Fire. Back. What's wrong down there?
Well, I don't know, sir.
Brady, get the data analyzer ready. We'll have to correct for a new takeoff time.
That's the first time I ever heard of engine failure before takeoff.
Well, better before than after. Engine room?
Yes, sir.
What's happening? Your boys ready yet?
No, sir.
Well, burn it, man. Get going. I want those engines started.
Sir.
What is it?
I don't quite know what to say.
Well, say something or I'll have you busted.
We can't start the engines, Commander. At least I can.
Well, why not?
I don't know.
Klein, put Klein on.
Lieutenant Klein, sir.
Lieutenant, what is going on down there? Is there something wrong with the engines?
No, sir. I've double-checked them.
Well, then let's get them heated up or we'll be on this godforsaken planet the rest of our lives.
We can't do it, sir.
Klein, suppose you tell me exactly why you can't start the engines. Can you do that?
Yes, sir.
All right, why?
Because, sir, we can't remember how.
What?
Yes, sir. We've forgotten how to start the engines.
Lieutenant, report up here in 1 minute. Bring Dr. Spencer with you.
Yes, sir.
All right, Brady, where have you got it?
Got what, Iron?
Don't play innocent. You and I have been doing planet surveys together for 15 years. You carry enough dead weight in grain alcohol on every trip to keep you happy for a million light years. Now, obviously, the boys in the engine room have gotten into it.
Impossible.
Where is it?
I got a few fists in my locker, but nobody's touched it. I checked a few minutes ago.
Well, then somebody has got some in the engine room. Come in.
Lieutenant Klein, sir, I brought Dr. Spencer as ordered.
Hello, Doc. Did Klein here tell you what's going on?
He did.
How long will it take you to get these guys sobered up?
I can't.
Why not?
Because they're not drunk. I tested Klein in my office.
Now, wait a minute, Doc. Are you trying to get me to actually believe that these men, intergalactic engineers with years of hyperfission experience, have forgotten how to start the engines of this ship?
That's right.
You're serious?
Dead serious, Ira. Something, somehow, has caused these men to forget how to start the engines.
There it was. It fit in perfectly with a lot of other annoying little things that have been happening to us ever since we put down on Planet 9. It was to have been a routine exploration of a low-grade, uninhabited planet. Some routine exploration. All right, Klein, now listen to me. Do you have manuals aboard? Engineering manuals?
Yes, sir.
Take the engine room boys and study those manuals. They'll tell you how to start the ship, won't they?
Yes, sir.
Okay, get going. Doc, I'd like you to stay here with me and Brady for a minute.
Okay.
Report back to me, Klein.
Yes, sir.
Okay, Doc, you're supposed to be an expert on space medicine. What is it?
I've never seen anything like it, Ira.
Brady?
Search me, Captain. I've seen them with space blues, alien psychoses, the works. But I've never seen a disease that could make a crew forget how to start the engines.
Maybe it isn't a disease.
Okay, what then?
Maybe it's a deliberate thing.
You mean they're faking?
No, I know Klein and the others too well for that. I mean, maybe there's some outside influence.
Doc, we've surveyed this planet from top to bottom. We know there isn't a living cell on it.
What about the junkyard?
What junkyard?
Oh, he means that pile of rusty space engine parts we found. The boys nicknamed it the junkyard.
He's right. Somebody put it there.
Well, we know that another spaceship landed here. We know that from the blast marks on the rock. We know that for some unexplained reason, they took their engine apart and tried to put it together again. We know they succeeded in building a much simpler engine, leaving a lot of spare parts, and we know that they took off. The blast-off marks tell us that, too.
What we don't know is whether or not they left somebody behind. Or something.
What about that stone tower, Ira?
The boys looked it over. It's just a pile of stones. They probably threw them together as a shelter while they were rebuilding their engine.
Oh, that sounds too simple.
I don't like that tower, Ira.
Why not?
I don't know. It was scary. It had that black look about it. The smell of death. I felt it when I walked past with Klein and MacGyver.
Oh, that's the Celt in you. Banshees and spooks.
I still don't like it. I need a drink.
Skip it. We should be ready to blast off in a few minutes. Engine room. Engine room. What's going on down there? Engine room. Lieutenant Klein.
Daddy. Is that you, Daddy? Did you bring me a present? Daddy, I'm scared.
Holy mackerel, that's Klein. He's gone off his rocker. Klein! Doc, I think we better get down to that engine room.
Well,
When Doc examined Klein, he found him to have the mind and memory of a 6-year-old.
That's it, Ira. Something drained Klein of his memory. And that's as much as I can tell you.
Well, that's a big help.
Here's the manual he was reading.
Well, at least we can follow this manual and get off this stinking planet. Hand it to me.
Right here. Anything wrong, Ira? Is it all there?
It's all here, Doc. This is the engine manual that tells all about the engines. How they operate, how to locate trouble, how to fix them, how to start them.
Well, what is it then? You're sweating like a pig.
All of a sudden, I can't remember the symbols. Doc, I've forgotten how to read. I left the engine room and went out through the lock to stand on the outside platform of the ship. I looked over the junkyard where the metal of the rusted engine parts gleamed. There was a riddle there. A riddle we hadn't been able to figure out. Why had an alien spaceship landed here, ripped out its engines, and then put together a simple, less efficient engine and taken off again? And they had worked in an awful hurry, judging by the mess they left. Why? Why?
Mind if I join you, Ira?
No, help yourself, Doc. How's Klein?
We've made him some toys. He's playing with them. I've assigned Mac to see that he doesn't hurt himself.
Doc.
Yes?
Have you got any ideas on what's happening to us?
Well, man experiences incidents, gathers knowledge, knows emotions. Then, as he grows older, he begins to forget those experiences. Forget that knowledge. That's what life is. A long series of forgettings. Here, on 9, in some impossible way, the forgetting is speeded up. It happens overnight.
No, there's more to it than that. Well, I'm going back to my cabin and try to get some rest.
That you, Ira?
That's me, Batters.
What gives?
We're in a jam.
There's been planets I wouldn't mind being marooned on, you know. But this ain't one of them. There's something here, Ira. I can feel it.
Yes, I can feel it myself. Maybe we should have looked around more.
Klein looked around. Klein was the one found that tower.
Bertie, that's right. He did.
He said he didn't like it. He said it scared him.
In the morning, Bad Ears, we'll go and see that tower. In the morning, I took Doc and MacIver and Brady with me, and we walked across the valley to the stone tower. It wasn't much of a tower. Maybe 8 or 9 feet high, made of rocks piled one on top of the other.
Pretty solid. Well built and odd. Type F culture, I'd say.
Did anybody bother to look inside this thing? MacIver, you were here with Klein yesterday.
Yes, sir. We couldn't find a way in, Captain. Klein poked around but gave up.
Well, we'll make a way in. Stand back. I think I can shoot the top off it. Oh, now that should be big enough for a man to lower himself into. Okay, pass a rope around my shoulders.
Captain.
Yes?
In case there's anything, well, dangerous, maybe I ought to go. After all, I'm survey engineer.
MacIver's right, Ira.
Okay, Mac, your responsibility.
Yes, sir. Just fasten the rope under my arms.
Mm-hmm.
That's it. Now, I'll climb up and lower myself in. If I pull twice, haul me out. One pull means okay. Give me a hand, Brady. Huh?
How about a quick shot of whiskey first?
Never touch it. Ready? No.
Can you see inside?
Black as a tomb. I'm going to lower myself. Pay out a little rope. Well, it's been lovely. Here we go.
One tug. He's on the ground inside.
Yeah, I wonder what he's found.
I still don't like it.
Oh, Brady, there's probably not a thing in there except if you... And there's 2 tugs. 3. Come on, haul them out.
Yeah, Brady, help me pull the top.
Right. Easy now, Mac. What the heck is in there anyway? Mac? Mac?
Dada? Dada?
Holy jumping asteroids. Doc, he's flipped.
No, he hasn't lost his mind. He's just reverted to babyhood.
We stood there at the foot of the tower, stunned. MacIver sat on the ground, happy as a clam, playing with his fingers and talking happy little nonsense syllables. Doc, take a look at him. Make sure that he's okay physically.
Check. If it's fright, his pulse will be way up. Mac, let me have your hand. That's a good fellow. Now. Good heavens.
What is it?
I've forgotten what the normal pulse rate is. Pulse. Pulse?
Doc, let's get out of here. Brady, pick up MacGyver and bring him back to the ship. Come on, let's get away from this tower. A few minutes later, Brady and I sat in the captain's quarters. He didn't do much talking, just sat and tipped his bottle to his lips ever so often. Well, at least we know in a general way what we're up against.
Do we?
We know there's been knowledge lost, important information forgotten.
Check.
Now, that memory, that lost skill, that knowledge went somewhere. Maybe there's something in that tower that takes it away. And I have a silly feeling we might even get it back.
Have a drink.
That is, get a couple of men, volunteers.
Now?
Now.
What for?
We're going to find out what's inside that tower. A rotating infrared movie camera into the tower, took some pictures, and went back to the ship for a look. There was something in there, all right.
Now, as far as we can determine, this thing we photographed is shaped like a watermelon standing on end. The movement of the hairs all over it suggests vibrations, such as an antenna of an insect. Underneath are wires leading to terminals that seemed plugged right into the thing.
You think it's a form of life?
My guess is a combination of living organism and machine. After all, man and machines work together. The difference is that man retains his individual identity.
Well, since it doesn't locomote, somebody or something must have put it there.
Exactly.
It looks like some kind of communication organism.
If it is, it's a communication machine that is built to take in information rather than pass it along.
Doc, do you really think that egg in there has been stealing our memory?
Why not?
Well, because it's too wild, that's why not.
It's no wilder than a lot of other things we found. Say that that egg is a device for gathering knowledge.
But there's no knowledge here to gather. I mean, how often does a ship land on an out-of-the-way melon like this?
Wait a minute, Brady. Who says that knowledge has to be collected here?
What?
I said, why do we assume that knowledge has to be collected right here on Planet Nine? We forget things back on Earth, don't we?
Good Lord.
Suppose you were some race setting out fish traps for knowledge, and you had plenty of time to gather it. Where would you put your traps? On a planet swarming with intelligent beings where the traps would be found and destroyed or their secrets snatched away? Or would you put them out on some second-rate world where nobody would ever bother them?
Good heavens, I'd pick a spot just like this.
Let me fill in this picture, Doc. I think that some unknown race is bent on trapping knowledge throughout the galaxy.
Ira, if what you say is true, if it is, then every time someone on Earth forgets something, it's because one of these eggs has drained it out of him.
Well?
It's too fantastic.
Have you got a better guess?
No.
The question is, what do we do next? If anybody gets near that egg, he winds up like some puling little baby.
You were pretty near it that first day. Did you forget anything?
Well, how should I know? I was too pleasantly lit up on grain spirits to know the difference.
Well, the question is still, what now?
I'm going outside to think.
Ira.
Yes?
There is one thing to keep in mind.
What is that, Doc?
If those are memory traps, then there must be a way for somebody to empty them. And if we're ever going to get away from here, what's gone in has got to come out.
I stood out on the platform of the ship and tried to make some sort of pattern of it. Forgetfulness. That was the key word. All through the galaxy, in every culture, there was forgetfulness. There were lots of learned theories, of course, kinks in the brain, neuroses, data processing. But suppose they were wrong. Might it not be that forgetfulness was caused by thousands upon thousands of these memory traps planted throughout the galaxy, nibbling away at the conscious memory of all the sentient beings that lived among the stars? On Earth, a man forgets slowly because the traps are far away. But here, in their very shadow, a man forgets suddenly. And then another thought entered my mind. What kind of race had set these traps? How did they empty them? How?
Brady!
Huh?
Where do you keep your liquor?
Now, Chief.
Come on, where?
It's in my locker.
Get it out of there, all of it.
Ira.
That's a direct order.
Okay. All of it.
That it?
Yeah. I never thought I'd see the day when you pulled rank on me, Ira. If you confiscate this stuff, so help me, I'll never
forget. Who said anything about confiscating? That is, have you ever really hung one on? I mean, just got pie-eyed drunk?
Well, let's see. Yeah, there was once on Mars.
Was that the worst?
It was beautiful. Took me 3 days to sober up. They say I fought off the whole galactic patrol for hours.
Well, do you think you got enough here to get that polluted again?
I got a pretty good supply, Ira.
Well, that's good, because in 1 minute, I'm going to give you a direct order to hang on the biggest, most monstrous drunk in the entire history of the universe. But first, you have to volunteer.
I volunteer.
No, not until I explain why I'm doing this.
Ira, this sort of project don't need reasons. It's a pleasure.
Let me finish. You know that egg up in the tower?
Yeah.
The minute you get near it, it grabs your mind, wipes it clean, right?
Yeah.
And a lead space helmet doesn't shield you, as we saw with MacIver.
Right.
Now, Doc thinks this egg is a kind of communications thing.
It must be.
Okay, you're a communications man. What do you do when you can't shield a communication?
Well, that's easy. You scramble it. Any fool knows. Holy mackerel.
Exactly. Are you still game?
You think it'll work?
I don't know. I think it might.
Well, suppose it doesn't.
Maybe you're a babbling infant like Klein and MacIver.
If we don't stop that thing, it'll happen anyway.
Unless we can remember how to start the engines.
Okay, Ira. I'll do it. When do I start?
Right now.
Well, Ira, here's Mud and your ever-loving intergalactic eyeballs. You know something? I'm beginning to like this mission already.
Well, that kills the last bottle.
How am I doing, our old buddy?
You're not drunk enough. I should have picked somebody like Doc, except he'd probably pass out.
I'm not drunk enough, huh, old buddy pal?
Not yet.
Well, then, in which case, old buddy, I'm going to have to do something I never like to have to do.
What's that?
I'm going to have to go into my extra special emergency reserve supply. It's a little supply I keep in case of getting marooned on a planet, you know? I don't like to go into it, but in this case, it's my duty. I'm a rambling wreck from Georgia Tech and a heck of an engineer. A rambling wreck from Georgia Tech and a heck of an engineer. Woo! Blast off!
Okay, I guess you're ready. What do you think, Doc?
Most amazing thing I've ever seen.
Is he drunk enough?
What I want to know is what's keeping him conscious.
Okay, Bad Ears, on your feet. Help him up, Doc.
Right.
Rambling wreck from Georgia Tech.
Let's go, Bad Ears.
Right. Rambling wreck from Georgia Tech.
Somehow we pushed, hauled, and stumbled Bad Ears Brady out of the ship and up the rocks to the egg tower. We erected a tripod over the hole with a block and tackle, passed a rope around Brady's chest, and hauled him over the entrance to the tower. There he swung like some overstuffed pig, singing raucously under the eerie moonlight.
Rambling wreck from Georgia Tech!
Well, what do you say, Ira?
We got the earphones on him so they can't slip off.
They're on.
Well, I guess we're ready to lower him.
Ira.
Yep.
You sure? It's a man's life.
I'm not sure, Doc. But as commander of this expedition, I sometimes have to risk the lives of my men.
Okay, Ira.
Lower away before I start to get sober. Lower away. Blast off. Fire one. Fire two. Bon voyage, Ira.
Good luck, Brady.
Good luck. He's at the bottom, Ira. Yeah.
That is, can you hear me?
Get your hands out of my hair. Something's got his hands in my hair, Ira.
Well, the thing must be picking at his brain. Brady, listen to me. Do you see the egg?
See it? It's my buddy, Ira. My little old egghead buddy. You and me buddies, egghead, right? Have a drink.
Oh, good Lord, he's got a bottle with him. He's pouring it on the egg. Brady, listen to me. The wires.
Wires?
The lead wires you took in with you.
Yeah.
Pull out the studs on the egg and hook your wires to it. You got that?
Just a minute.
Me and Ager's gonna have a drink.
Oh, good heavens. It's no use, Ira. He's too drunk to know what he's doing.
I'll try again.
Brady, listen. Your friend, the egg, can't hear you, see? He can't have a drink until you hook your wires into him. You got that?
Sure. That's an awful thing. That's dreadful. Okay.
What's he doing? Doc, you getting any impulses?
Not a thing.
Maybe we better haul him out. If he starts to sober up...
Maybe we'd better.
Okay, one, two...
Wait a minute.
What?
I'm getting something, Ira. What? This is fantastic. Oh, I'm getting something.
All right, haul him out, quick.
Right.
Come on.
A rambling wreck from Georgia Tech. A rambling wreck.
Brady, are you all right? Doc, help me. Take a look at him. Is he okay?
Yes, he's okay. Just passed out.
Well, let's get him back to the ship.
Right. You know what, Ira?
What?
Tomorrow about 9 a.m., we're going to be in on the most colossal hangover in the history of mornings after.
We were in on more than Doc Spencer had bargained for. More than any human being had any business being in on.
Oh.
Well, Brady, how do you feel?
Shoot me.
You turned the trick.
Trick?
The tower. You hooked into the egg. The stuff is rolling out now. Doc and the boys have got a recording hooked up. The stuff they're listening in on is enough to set your teeth on edge.
What's that?
The information that mind trap has been collecting for hundreds of years. It'll take us years to sort it out, but we're getting some of it straight already.
Any of our own stuff?
Plenty.
Anything on engines?
Well, not on our engines.
So?
We got the dope on the junkyard engine. Mac and the boys are hoping to get it assembled. We're ripping out our own engines and just keeping some of the parts.
Another junkyard, huh?
Another junkyard. The engine we're building now is superior to anything ever built.
Pretty handy little gadget, that egg. Only one thing.
What's that?
Tell Doc if he comes across a good hangover remedy to let me know, huh? Oh!
It took us about 6 days to assemble new engines using some of our parts and some of the advanced designs from the junkyard. During most of that time, Doc Spencer sat down at the tower with a set of headphones monitoring the information from the egg. He was like a man possessed. I didn't think anything unnatural was happening until the night of the sixth day. Well, that does it. The boys have got the engines ready for blast-off. There's a full moon, too.
We should be able to lift her by tomorrow morning, huh?
We're blasting off in exactly 1 minute, that is.
What?
In exactly 1 minute.
But Ira, Doc, and some of the techno boys are down monitoring that egg.
I know it.
Well, it'll take them 20 minutes to get back into the ship with all that equipment.
They're not getting back.
Huh?
I said they're not getting back.
Ira, are you nuts?
Come here, that is. I want you to take a look through this field scope. You can get a good close-up of Doc and the boys who have been monitoring that egg.
Now, wait till I get it focused.
You got him?
Yeah.
Take a close-up.
Mother in heaven.
You see why we have to leave them here?
Those faces, they're like some kind of beast. What is it, Ira? What's happened to them?
The same thing that must have happened to the crew of the last ship that touched here. The same thing that made them blast out of here in such a tearing hurry.
What?
That is, there isn't only knowledge in that thing. Those boys are monitoring something else.
Something else.
Personality, that is. They're not human anymore. They're turning alien. They were still there when the ship roared up away from Planet Nine and pointed her silver nose toward Earth. We could see them in the scopes. A group of tiny figures crouched over the recording equipment, their earphones plugged into the egg. They didn't even look up when we blasted off. They were no longer human now. They were something else. Something a million light years old and of another world.
Tonight, by transcription, X-1 has brought you Junkyard, a story from the pages of Galaxy written by Clifford D. Simak and adapted for radio by George Lefferts. Featured in the cast were John Larkin, Bob Hastings, Mercer McLeod, Stan Early, and Jack Orison. Your announcer, Fred Collins. X-1 was directed by Daniel Sutter and is an NBC Radio Network production.
And another break. Hopefully this will be the last one. Finally, another of my favorites, from Murder at Midnight, The Ape Song, was first aired on March the 31st of 1947. Murder at Midnight was produced in New York City and heard over the Mutual Network starting on December the 16th of 1946 and would run until September the 8th of 1947. It was produced by radio station WJZ and would occasionally reproduce scripts that had been performed on Inner Sanctum. As you might imagine, this practice allowed the show to feature tales of murder and macabre by some of radio's top writers without really paying top dollar. Worked out pretty well for them.
Seemed to be making for the roof. But on the top floor, we finally caught up with her.
Crane, please, please. That ape, get him out of here. I'll do anything, anything.
You treated me like an animal, Cecily. And now an animal shall treat you as you deserve, choke you to death.
Midnight. The witching hour when the night is darkest and our fears the strongest, our strength at its lowest ebb. Midnight, when the graves gape open and death strikes. How? You'll learn the answer in just a moment in The Ape Song. And now, Murder at Midnight, tales of mystery and terror by radio's masters of the macabre. Our story by Peter Martin is The Ape Song. Night and fog shroud a nondescript freighter just in from Africa and now unloading its cargo in New York Harbor. Down in the ship's deepest hold stands Crane Folliot, the famous big game hunter. Before him is an iron cage containing his latest conquest, a restless thing of panic and hysteria and insensate passions, a huge ape.
Quiet. Don't be afraid. I'm not going to kill you, hurt you. I've killed too much already. And besides, I need you to live, need your help. Now, that's better. Yes, my friend, you shall live to save me from death. A death in life.
I'll be taking him off in a minute.
Huh? Oh, good.
Lucky thing we were able to get a hold of another truck.
Why the university forgot to send their truck is beyond me. Still, I don't think keeping the animal in my cellar overnight will harm him or anybody.
Look at him shake, though. He's scared.
Well, not scared, exactly. That's because, like all apes taken from their natural habitat, he imagines he's in the presence of death.
Death?
Yes.
What's he doing now, opening and closing his mouth as if he were trying to sing or something?
How did you know?
No. Know what?
Oh, I'm sorry. No, you wouldn't know. They can sing, though.
Yeah?
They do. But only when they're in the presence of death. We rode home through the foggy night in the truck, the ape and I. The house was dark when we got there, and I had to give the driver and his helper an extra $20 to take the canvas-covered crate holding the ape around to the back door and into the cellar. Walking up the cellar stairs, I entered the front hall and...
Elliot, is that you?
Dr. Murchison.
Yes, welcome home.
What are you doing here?
Your wife was just going out when I came here, but she let me in and I've been waiting for you.
Waiting for me?
Yes. I was about to go myself when I heard a noise downstairs.
Oh, I suppose you want to know where the ape is. Well, he's downstairs in the cellar.
I see. Folliot, why did you bring the ape here rather than to my laboratory?
Well, the laboratory truck never arrived.
What? It's impossible. I personally arranged for it to meet you at the pier.
Why are you questioning me, Dr. Murchison? You don't really think I want an ape as a house guest, do you? The only thing I was interested in was to get the ape to a safe place until morning. Then I was going to call you.
I see.
Can't you wait to start cutting him up, whatever you intend to do with him? Do you want to take him with you now?
Well, you know that's impossible, Folliot. And you know we don't intend to cut him up.
Well, I'm sorry, Doctor, but the strain taking care of him, you know what delicate animals they are. Won't you come into my study and we can talk?
Thanks, Folliot, but now that I know he's safe, I must be running along.
As you wish. When will you send the truck around, take him to the laboratory?
Oh, around noon, I should say.
Good.
Get some sleep, man. You look terribly tired.
Yes, good, peaceful sleep at last.
Hello, someone's at the door.
Yes, I imagine it's my wife.
Oh, Crane.
Hello, Cecily.
You're back.
Yes.
Why?
Why? That's a strange question. You know Dr. Murchison, don't you?
Yes.
I was just about to leave, Mrs. Folliot.
You must excuse my wife, Doctor. She's so pleased at seeing me that she's forgotten her manners.
I understand. Well, I'll be in touch with you.
Brian?
Good night, Mrs. Folliot.
Good night. Crane, you promised you'd stay away until November.
Yes, I know I did. But the thought of you all alone in this big house doing nothing but waiting for me to return to your welcoming arms... What else could I do but rush home as quickly as I could, my dear?
Don't be sarcastic, Crane.
On the contrary, my dear. I'm not being half as sarcastic as I'd like to be.
Excuse me, I'm going to bed.
But don't you care for me just a little, Cecily? Just enough to kiss me goodnight?
Let me pass.
I've never asked very much of you, you know. No more than the friendly pat on the head you give to your dog.
I said, let me pass.
Yes, Cecily. But first, there's something I must tell you. How tired I am of being a hunter, of killing wild animals instead of enjoying the happiness of my home with you.
You seem to enjoy your hunting trips well enough. You're always going on them and bragging about them to everybody. Now, let me pass, Crane.
Please believe me, Cecily. Hunting is only a substitute. A very unsatisfactory substitute for the love I hope to receive from you. I never do.
I thought we'd settled all that.
Yes, but I never dreamed you'd treat me like some loathsome animal you couldn't bear near you, as though I wasn't a man, but an ape.
When are you leaving on your next trip?
When?
Yes. Because until you do, I'm going away.
If you hate me so much, my dear, why don't you go to Reno and get divorced?
You know my family doesn't approve of divorce.
Of course they don't. Especially when it's a matter of losing the Folliot millions along with a husband.
How can you be so disgusting?
Something terrible has happened to me, Cecily. Something which forbids me ever to go hunting again.
Don't make silly excuses. You know you love to hunt.
Not anymore, Cecily. Something has happened that makes me terrified ever to hunt again.
What on earth are you talking about?
I really can't explain it, my dear. But on this last trip, every time I killed a wild animal, I imagined I was killing you. I watched her run up the stairs in terror. I heard the slam of her bedroom door. I stood there at the foot of the stairs for a moment, dazed, yet more certain than ever of what I had to do. And then, quite unexpectedly, I felt the wet sting of tears on my cheeks. Yes, there were tears, but no sound. I thought of the ape in the hold of the ship silently opening and closing his mouth. Some outside force seemed to be guiding me now, as though I was a mechanically controlled robot. I began walking down the hallway to the cellar door. The darkness didn't frighten me. It was my friend. I went down the cellar steps in perfect calm, never thinking to snap on the light. No, it was the darkness that soothed me, whispered to me. The darkness and the presence of my friend. He sensed me, of course. And more than that, he expected me. He knew I was coming. I went to him. There he was, outlined in the dim light of a faraway street lamp, coming into the cellar from the grating over my head. Yes, my friend. You want to be free, don't you? Yes, and why not be free? But before I let you out of your cage, we must understand each other. There is a price you must pay for your freedom. Am I really being so unreasonable? Listen, you shall do what I command you to do with an ecstasy of satisfaction. Do you hear? For this time, it is no animal you will see die, but a human being. And more than that, my friend, you will not only see her die, but you yourself shall kill her, shall avenge all the terrible deaths I have dealt your fellow brothers of the animal kingdom. I see you are pleased, and you should be. Didn't I kill your mate? But I tell you, Cecily drove me to it in my need to quench my murder lust against her. And now, my friend, you shall act as my conscience. You shall kill Cecily in revenge. Your spirit shall be my spirit, and Cecily will die. Yes, yes, you do understand. Here in my hand is the key to your cage, the key to your freedom and mine. We have made our bargain, haven't we? Yes, yes. We understand each other as though we were two brothers. Yes. Come on. Now, upstairs to her room. It is there that you shall sing at last. Yes, your song of freedom, your ape song.
And so man and ape start for the room of their victim. Start up the stairs side by side in the darkness as the clock strikes 12 for murder at midnight. And now back to Murder at Midnight and the Ape Song. Crane Folliot and his ape continue up the steps to Cecily's room.
We went up the cellar stairs together. And it didn't seem strange when the ape took my hand as though wishing me to guide him. And then for a moment I was afraid of trouble. The ape became fascinated with the heavy carpeting in the hallway, patting it with his hand as an infant plays with sand. But finally I got him to stand up and come with me. We made hardly any sound as we climbed the main staircase leading to her room.
Who is it?
What is it, my dear? What's the matter?
Oh, something in the room. I hear it. I see its eyes.
But that's fantastic, my dear.
There. There it is. Crane, Crane, what are you doing to me?
I see nothing. I hear nothing.
Crane, let go of my arm.
In a moment, but won't you kiss me, please?
You're going to kill me.
Oh, no, no, not I. Come, aren't you going to kiss me just once, as you used to in the old days?
All right. Yes, anything. But let me go.
Good. Now, let me hold you in my arms. Oh, Cecily, I need you so. Why have I lost you? Why did you forsake me, Cecily?
Go!
Cecily, come back. Don't run. You can't get away. Very well, if that's the way you want it. It was quite a chase. I followed them as they ran through the house from room to room, floor to floor. She seemed to be making for the roof, but I knew if she got away from me, she'd never, never shake off the ape. Finally, on the top floor, we caught up with her in the attic.
Crane! Please! Please, that ape! Get him out of here, Crane! I'll do anything!
You treated me like an animal, Cecily. And now an animal shall treat you as you deserve. Choke the life out of you. There she is! Over there in the corner.
No! No, Crane!
She made me kill your mates. Kill her! Kill her! Kill her!
Crane! Crane!
Goodbye, Cecily. I felt wonderful. I stood over her body and thought I could smell the sea and hear the pounding of the clean waves. And I felt sleepy again. Really sleepy again. I knew I could sleep now. I don't know how long I stood there or how long the doorbell was ringing until I remembered that it wasn't I that had killed her, but the ape. I was safe. Why not go downstairs and open the door?
Couldn't get a taxi, and I wanted to see the ape first thing in the morning anyway, so I thought I'd come back to that comfortable sofa of yours.
Dr. Murchison, the ape has escaped.
Escaped?
Yes, he jumped out of a window into a tree after killing my wife.
Folliot, what are you saying?
Yes, right after you left. The first I knew of it was when she screamed. I ran upstairs to her room, but...
Queer.
Why was that?
I merely said it was queer. I can't tell you how sorry I am, Folliot, for you.
Sorry? For me?
Shouldn't I be?
In a way. Yes, it's lucky you did come back. We'll have to organize a search for the ape, of course. Call the police.
Yes. I am sorry for you, Folliot. Terribly sorry.
The days that followed were the happiest of my life. At the inquest, the coroner's verdict was death by accidental strangulation. The ape could not be found, and the official opinion was that he drowned in the river, his body carried out to sea. Everything had worked out perfectly until I began to become aware of something strange and frightening and horrible. All this was happening to me. One day on the street.
You dropped a coin, sir.
Oh, thanks, that dime. I have it.
Did you hurt your finger? Here, let me pick it up for you.
Thank you, my thumb. Somehow I can't seem to bring it across. My thumb was no longer opposable. I couldn't bring it across my fingers. I never realized what it could mean until a few days later at a ball game.
Get your scorecard at the game. Can't tell nothing without a scorecard, mister.
Never mind.
Come on, mister. Only a dime a scorecard. You don't want to spoil the pleasure of the game just for a dime, do you?
Move on, you idiot.
Yeah, who are you? A quiz kid or something?
I said get out of here. Take your hands off of me, you ape, you. What was happening to me? I could hardly force myself to think about it. But I had to, especially after what happened at my club.
I say there, fellow, you old man. Have a seat in the chat.
Thank you, Sam, but I've got to be going.
Yes, of course. I see.
You see what?
Lumbago, eh? Can't straighten up your back. Going to a doctor, eh?
You think it would help, do you?
I don't know. But you certainly can't spend the rest of your life bending over like that. With your hands hanging halfway to your knees.
A half hour later, I was in Murchison's office.
Now, you must take it easy, Folliette. We all have our off days, you know.
You've got to help me, Dr. Murchison. You don't know what I'm going through.
I wonder. You do look rather...
I can't stand wearing shoes anymore. They torture me. And I can't straighten my back up.
Have you ever had rheumatism? Any severe back injury?
Rheumatism? You sit there talking like that when I've caught myself making sounds like an ape? Don't you realize what's happening? That's what I'm becoming, an ape. You're a psychiatrist, aren't you? We'll do something. You've got to do something.
Quit your whimpering and listen. I can help you, but only if you cooperate.
I'll do anything.
Admit you arranged for your wife's murder.
What?
With the ape's help. Everything points to it, Folliette. Bringing the ape to your house, your strange behavior before and after I left. And now the transference.
I don't know what you're talking about.
It's quite simple. Arranging for the ape to strangle your wife put you legally in the clear. But you can't strangle your guilt. You can only suppress it. And unconsciously in your guilt, you have taken on the actual characteristics of the ape.
If you say that again, I'll kill you.
Killing me would only prove your guilt twice over. Be sensible, Folliette. Trust me. I've taken extensive note on your case.
You've taken notes?
Yes, because I knew that some sort of reaction would set in. Folliette, no, keep away from me.
No, you're going to turn me over to the police. You're against me, too. Everyone's against me trying to hunt me down, but you won't get me. You won't.
Please stop
I dropped him, and he fell to the floor gasping. And then I tore open the door and ran. I didn't know where I was going, what I was going to do next. I only knew I had to hide. I found an abandoned house, hid in the cellar, and there in the darkness, it all became clear. Ape. The ape who had killed Cecily. I was the ape. That meant he was Crane Folliette, and that meant... Yes. I had to find him somehow. Kill him for killing Cecily. And that way become my old self again. Abe, where could I go? Where would I hide if I were he? Where there is green, yes, and trees, and rocks. Abe, yes, in the park. Night in the park, I threw off my shoes and walked barefoot, concealed in the night as I hunted my mortal enemy. Piece by piece, I discarded my clothes, my jacket, my shirt, my trousers, walking like the animal I had become. My eyes were sharper than they'd ever been. I could see even in the darkness. And then... as the moon started to go down, I climbed a ridge. There were caves, cages, stone houses, the zoo. And then I heard something that made the hair prickle on the back of my neck. My fingers itched and my body shook as I heard the sound that told me I had found my enemy, the ape. I jumped down toward the sounds, my lips puffing in and out with my heavy breathing, my head pounding like a trip hammer, my entire body aflame with the hot blood of murder. I ran to where the sounds came from, and there was a locked steel door. The ape was snarling, daring me to come near him. I ran around to the other side, wrenched a fire axe from the wall, and came back to the door. I smashed at the lock with the sharp edge of the axe, opened the door, and leaped into the cage. He reared at me with his hind legs, and I sprang at his throat.
Hold him, Moses. Jake, get your gun quick. There's a man in there.
Yes.
Put me up there.
Die. Die for killing Cecily. And die in me, too. Let me be Folliette. Folliette, do you hear?
Watch out. The cage is open.
Dead. It's dead, and I free!
Oh, 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 oh.
Give me this check. Let him have it. I pronounce him dead.
Who'd have thought a man could make a sound like that? It was dark and we thought the ape had killed him, so Jake just fired.
What gets me is his trying to kill an ape with his bare hands and doing it.
To his crazed mind, this was the same ape he provoked into killing his wife.
I'll never forget that sound as long as I live. Never.
The complete transference into ape. Yet he could have been saved. Look at them lying on the ground. Too bad we couldn't have gotten here a minute sooner.
Sure left an easy trail, dropping his shoes and clothes after him piece by piece.
Ape and man on the ground, side by side.
It ain't pretty.
His toes turned in, puffs of hair from the ape's throat still clutched between his fingers, his teeth biting into his lower lip. Poor Folliot. Or should I say poor humans? How close to animals we really are.
Two bodies lying side by side in the darkness, with no one to say which was the victim, as the clock strikes 12 for
Murder at Midnight.
Remember to be with us again when death pads through the night with glowing eyes and the clocks strike 12 for
Murder at Midnight.
The part of the big game hunter was played by Raymond Edward Johnson. With music by Charles Paul, Murder at Midnight was directed by Anton M. Leder.
Well, that's another fine night transmissions in the can. So, well, it's almost in the can. Before I go, I want to mention that you can write me, if you're so inclined, at nighttransmissions@gmail.com. I also want to mention that the website, www.nighttransmissions.com, is out there on the internet, and there's a good deal of ancillary material there, more details about the shows, and even the occasional link to go a little bit deeper into the history of the show. Some people actually think it's worth a visit. Well, I don't want to lie to you. Nobody's ever actually told me that. On second thought, why shouldn't I lie to you? I mean, everybody lies to us, huh? It's a wonderful place. Free pretzels and beer. Go, go. You'll like it there. I'm Gary Clinton, and you're whoever the hell you are.
Thank you.